Thank you for the introduction and thank you for the invitation. I just learned some of the things I'm currently getting out. That's very exciting. Thanks so much for the introduction. So it is a big pleasure. Actually, rather for a lab that is actually involved with Liquidev. So in a way, I mean, it's kind of a big pleasure in a way to introduce Liquidev to you, but maybe you may have heard some about that. So the name of the game is about, going against transparency, what we have been doing for forever, almost when it comes to detection. The first question basically would be, why Liquidev? Why we want to basically look for yet another technology for detection? And there are many good reasons for that, but let me try to kick off by probably the big reason. So one of the big reasons, of course, that right now we have is that we are, surprised in a way. We have the standard model that basically can be characterized as an absolutely stunning success. But in fact, we're also surprised by the fact that this is a mystery, the success of the standard model in many ways. And we know the reason for that is because it is incomplete. We know already now that the standard model, despite its success, is incomplete. And this in itself is kind of a paradox. And because the question is, what is actually basically what is missing? And where is that basically these missing elements essentially of new physics? And this is why, long story short, we want to have basically explore nature better and better with higher precision. And it is to try to see a hint for these new possible physics. And this is despite, the huge effort essentially in the theory of possible scenarios, it's clear that this is about basically compelling new experiments with farther, sensitivity, better control of patterns, higher efficiency, and so on and so forth. So we are facing a major experimental target problem, and this is exactly why, in a way, we're trying to improve our detectors, our ability to see the nature deeper and deeper. So let me first kick off with a little disclaimer. I'm a neutrino physicist. I'm going to try to talk about a technology from a more generic way. You may notice that I'm going to be talking about neutrinos a bit more than maybe I should. But I will use it as an example. But if you have any questions regarding your specific expertise, and we may try to address that, and bear with me a little bit. And there you go. So I think that Liquidev can go well beyond the neutrino basically scenario, and this is very important as a matter of fact, as a feature of the technology. So in neutrino detectors, in fact, we have these beautiful pictures when it comes to our detectors. So this is Super Gamma-Gamma, a Nobel Prize 2015 for the discovery of neutrino oscillations, so one contribution, very important contribution to that, and it's not the only one. And when it comes to these kind of detectors, we typically, the reason why detectors are very large is because cross-section of neutrinos is extremely low. This is just a feature of weak interaction, long story short. And I'm going to disappoint you right away. I don't have a way to improve the cross-section of the neutrinos, so the only thing we're going to do is just make our detectors possibly better. So essentially, with those few neutrinos that interact, the idea is to basically learn more and more so that we actually basically get the most of these rare opportunity to see neutrinos interact. You would see actually that these detectors have one of the main features is that if you want to make a huge detector, you may ask yourself, what is the problem with the neutrino detectors? Well, it's cost, long story short. If you want to have a huge detector and you actually want to basically cover these huge volumes, you need to simplify it as much as you can. And that implies basically compromises, long story short, you lose information. And this is to allow to spend the name of the game, see if neutrinos were discovered. And it has been a challenge that, honestly speaking, we're still fighting. I would say that we're fighting every single day. And it's about basically trying to make something that is cost-effective, as simple as we can to lower the cost, and at the same time, as complex enough to extract as much information from neutrino interactions. And long story short, this implies typically, basically, I'm going to highlight, some examples, backgrounds out there. And whenever you see backgrounds, that we cannot recognize signal from background, very often I'd like you to think this way, this means technology is a limitation, typically, but especially in neutrinos, maybe not necessarily the same when you go to colliders, different rationality when it comes to detection, but to allow to stand essentially whenever you hit these background issues, to allow to stand is technology. Technology basically running out of munition, capabilities, handles, and this is basically what it comes down. So let me give you an example of a beautiful detector, Nobel Prize also. This is a snow detector that now has become the snow glass experiment. So this detector basically has an acrylic, and we have now scintillator, used to be heavy water or water inside, and there is basically this, we call it this bathroom where the photomultipliers are around. You can see the simplicity, but the elements of these kind of machines, And this is basically kind of what we've been doing. I mean, this is one of the most beautiful experiments architecture that we have done with this along the lines. But this is kind of, this basically gives you the spirit of what we do. So the long story short, we have this volume where the interactions are going to be seen, and everything else is about trying to understand the backgrounds. And let me give you some numbers so you appreciate that. The main problem of these detectors is that they have not hit. Whenever you actually get your detector gets hit, you get a flash of light. This is proportional to energy. You say, okay, something hit me, but you don't have a clue of what actually hit you, generally. And this implies essentially this detector has to be shielded. You have to put basically surrounded, basically shields. And sometimes you can use even the planet overpowered as a shielding because it's cosmogenic, so basically it's unavoidable. And to a large extent, what I'm going to try to convince you in this seminar, and this is all about technology. The technology is running out of fuel in a way, and this is going to basically be the problem. So let's consider, for example, these photomultipliers beautifully. I mean, they are put apart. You may wonder why they put this space. This is wasting a huge amount of volume. As a matter of fact, this volume that you see here is barely 10% of the total volume that is actually that it has been excavated. And this excavation has costed basically hundreds of millions of euros. Pounds, whatever you prefer. And actually the rest of the volume, this buffer volume, is already almost three times bigger than the volume that we use with the neutrinos. And if you actually consider there is another external volume that you use for muons, as a matter of fact, actually is even 10 times bigger. So long story short, you put, let's say, 100 million euros basically into the system, and out of that, only 10% of your volume is being used for neutrino. And that's, let's face it, not very impressive if you think about the numbers, but the reality is we don't know how to do it any better, or we, up to now, we don't know how to do it any better. The reason why the photomultipliers or this so-called buffer is there, a fantastic idea to some extent, but actually basically you make the detector three times smaller, is that there is radioactivity from the photocathodes of the photomultipliers, and this radioactivity is overkilling, so you just put your volume away, and of course this is great, but at the same time you lost an immense amount of volume. And the other problem basically with cosmogenics is that these detectors don't have any tracking, no whatsoever. In fact, these detectors are very good to say, my muon started here, my muon basically went out there, you have an entry exit point, and then you basically extrapolate with a straight line and a little bit of praying halfway through, because the reality is you don't have a clear vision of whether the muon is going straight, or whether the muon basically comes, kicks essentially something with high momentum, and basically it goes out there. You don't have a clue generating these detectors, and to a large extent this implies understanding cosmogenics, essentially coming from the muons, typically is very hard. When it comes here or here, you just don't know. So, in fact, this cosmogenic problem is to a large extent the reason why all these detectors are placed deep on the ground, sometimes 1 kilometer, sometimes even 2 kilometers, essentially underground. And to a large extent, this implies that basically when it comes to neutrino physics, we are a little bit still in the cavern, basically, in the analytic divide, think of that way. So we have to put all our detectors, all our neutrino civilization happens still underground. And of course, I mean, everybody's dreaming to get out of the cavern in a way, but this is actually very hard. And this is one of the things that actually that we're motivated in Liquid, or at least we think that we want to try out, is can we get basically out of basically the underground, basically world, and really start basically conquering the surface. If we did that, I mean, if you know the detector would start looking something like that, and this is just artificial intelligence, I mean, just checked, I mean, what kind of basically neutrino detector you get out of basically ChatGPT, and that's basically what it suggests. I mean, not about try, we can show something better later. And the idea basically is that now if the detectors were in this position, that would be much, much, much cheaper essentially to reveal. For example, these kind of tanks could be, for example, the petrol tanks that are being bombarded right now, not far from, but Boston is far enough from here, but nonetheless, I think these are the detectors are bad. So we know how to do this kind of things on surface and make them big. Just to give you a little bit of basically an appetizer, I mean, when it comes to basically what we are regarding neutrinos, I mean, let me highlight reactive neutrinos basically were discovered in the 50s. In fact, this was the discovery of the neutrino itself. And today, I mean, this was a Nobel Prize, by the way, and today is completely patent limited. This means the technology that we use today for reactive neutrinos, I mean, essentially is requiring something new, long story short. When it comes to solar neutrinos, discovered in the 60s, that was also a Nobel Prize. In fact, this is also background limited. We have to put the detector deep underground, and even so, it's actually extremely hard. When it comes to atmospheric neutrinos in the 80s, this is also background limited. That was also a Nobel Prize at the time. If you look at supernova, basically neutrinos, also Nobel Prize, also Bakken limited. In fact, everything is Bakken limited, but you can see that it was highly appreciated essentially to see all of those. Accelerators, I mean, since the 2000, roughly speaking, they are still basically limited by statistics. So far, Nova TTK being the state of the art. I think you have a seminar, beautiful. I'm sorry, I missed it. But I mean, this morning, so actually, you've seen basically that even accelerators are starting to get to the systematics, and this implies technology is soon going to be basically there. That is the case of Hyper-K, essentially, and Dune. But for T2K and Nova, to a large extent, the source, essentially, statistics is the problem. G-neutrinos, discovered in 2004. This is also Bakken limited. This is actually almost like a reactive neutrino. And you may have heard about basically double beta decay or proton decay. If anybody sees that, clearly that's going to be highly appreciated and essentially, I think, in Stockholm. But nonetheless, these are Bakken limited scenarios. And this is something that people are searching. This would imply new physics out there. And this may be one source of beautiful neutrinos. These are the neutrinos produced essentially in the Big Bang, essentially, era. I mean, this is something well beyond our reach so far. People trying, but not even our ability to see it. And this would be, of course, something extremely important, essentially, for our understanding of the universe. Long story short, as you can see, the menu of the neutrinos today, and I'm not saying that this is everything, but just to give you sort of a source, every single source of neutrinos that we know of that we can use are completely limited by backgrounds, and this implies technology may be the limitation. And let me try to basically give you some examples of that by bringing Liquido more into the scene. Right, so what is Liquido? So Liquido, long story short, is about this image. I think it can be summarized essentially in one image. So what we want to do with Liquido, and this is going to be hopefully a bit surprising and counterintuitive at the very beginnings, we want to basically confine the light locally without using, not using any type of external basically material, not any kind of pixelization or segmentation. So to allow us, then, is the art of getting information with light, but without actually using external means. I will explain why this is important. And this is to a large extent what we want to do, but now instrument it and master it, long story short. And in fact, Liquido is about using opaqueness instead of transparency. We're basically moving completely to the ground. Yes, we are desperate indeed, you may call it so, and indeed, that's probably basically a good way to see it. And to try to basically articulate imaging in a multidimensional way. And I'm going to emphasize basically that in a few minutes, and hopefully convince you that this is something that maybe we know how to do it now. So when it comes to imaging, let's consider the building blocks. What we want, if we have to dream, is something that whenever there is an energy deposition, essentially we're able to measure the energy. We have already that. And we want to know what energy that is a one-dimensional element in a space, x, y, and z, essentially. And if you have basically a point, essentially you have a sequence of points, you can have lines, these mean structs and points, you have information. And of course, timing, which is actually even very simple. I mean, to today's technology, we're reaching maybe the hundred of picoseconds doable in these kind of detectors. This is optional, but nonetheless, this is actually relatively easy to do in instrumentation. If we combine all this information, this means that you can have basically a lot of multidimensional information. And if the detector is fast enough, think of TPCs, typically you get a frozen image. What we want essentially is to see images that flow. So we can see actually like a film, what is actually happening at the speed of light in the actual detector. I'm going to see that in a few minutes. Fine, of course, simulation as for now, but you will see in 1 second. If we can essentially unlock all this information, you will see that we can actually start basically redoing all the physics, neutron physics that we have right now. So the way to do that is to confine the light, and that is easy to say. You can do it with a black hole. We don't know how to do detectors with black holes so far, unfortunately. And so the only way that we can do that is using basically another technique. So this is how photons manifest essentially in GM4, rays essentially going to infinity. These are fibers, for example, just to give an example. And if you actually go from this water-like scenario and you go into a milk-like scenario, photons are no longer going to behave essentially like rays. They're going to behave sort of like whirlpools, essentially, whirling essentially there. And what they're going to make essentially is an effective point in space that is proportional to energy and it has a timing. So it has position, it has time, and it has energy. So long story short, we have basically, this is the building block of our imaging capability. And it is that whenever there is one energy deposition there, this translates into a point essentially in space. And this point may vary in size, but we can make it as small as something of this size. And the idea basically would be that when we have events, we would have put in points in space, and we would see the correlation of time of all these points. We were able to work out this period of time. So going from this paradigm, this is transparency paradigm, to this paradigm, this is exactly what we're going to do. And we're going to use a scattering, elastic scattering. This is Rayleigh scattering and mean scattering, actually, that comes from free. As a matter of fact, what is difficult is that this is actually natural. In fact, to make detectors transparent, we actually work extremely hard, basically, to make that happen to the level, for example, supercritical gander, I mean, to the level of almost 100 meters, I mean, is the dimension end. What we want to do here is actually the light to scatter a lot. Of course, we don't want the light to be absorbed or to be lost, because otherwise you lose information. So what we want is the light to stay locally. And what is going to happen is that the photons are going to stay doing a random walk, exactly, just very close to the source. On average, a random walk means the photon never is just on average on the position, on the source, and everything else basically is done along. Of course, if the light stays local, you cannot use photon multipliers located very far away. So you need to go and hunt for this information. And we're going to put fibers, optical fibers. These cannot be transparent fibers because these fibers, what we need is these fibers essentially collect the light. I'm going to highlight that in 1 second. So long story short, all the physics of Liquido is just up in the sky, not today, actually. There are no clouds. So I'm basically spoiling my idea. If you have basically your eyes as a sensor and the foot and the sun as the light source, the reality is that the blue of the sky, this is Rayleigh scattering. And this is exactly one of the scatterings we're going to use, elastic scattering of photons. And we can also use Mie scattering. And the difference of this one, of course, is that you get basically a very color dependence. And these, the molecules in the water in the cloud, are actually of the right size, so you get this colorless behavior. And this is why you have white versus blue in the sky, as a matter of fact. The size of the molecules, in fact, in the cloud and in the atmosphere are different. And this black that you see in there is just this opaqueness. Essentially, the light is not able to go through because it's thick enough. So long story short, everything on Liquido works exactly that way. All the physics is actually there. So it's just right in front of us. So a Liquido detector, the best Liquido detector that we want, if we want basically strong scattering, is a white light detector, if it's Mie scattering driven. And in fact, we're going to go by 4 orders of magnitude. Essentially, the scattering, we're going to basically bring it down by 4 orders of magnitude. So essentially, this is a huge change. So in fact, this light that would have gone without interacting with our scattering over tenths of meter, I mean, it's going to interact with millimeters or sub-millimeter, and this means that we can make light bulbs of this size. Essentially, it's more than your hand. And this means that we're confining photons stochastically within basically centimeter scale or less. It depends, of course, your scattering length, which, by the way, is a variable. So Liquido is about that, essentially. And let me just show you how Liquido detector works. First, and the most important element, if you don't have that, you cannot see, you need to go to the source of where the light, basically the energy is deposited, and then you need fibers. These fibers have to be either wave-shifting fibers or basically scintillating fibers. Both of them actually work. Actually, these you can consider that a wave-shifting fiber is just a cheap scintillating fiber. A scintillating fiber gives light by itself, and the wave-shifting is just doing a little bit of wave-shifting on spokes, basically, essentially change. Why do you need that? And the reason is because if you don't have that, you don't get light into the fibers. The fibers are designed so any photon that comes in goes out just by snapping out, unless there is a little scattering, but this is basically to the per mil level also, with the less. So generally, if we don't basically make these fibers effectively active, you don't get light inside the fibers, long story short. And this is why we need these kind of fibers. Clear fibers do not work. I mean, well, your light level would be basically 4 orders of magnitude lower, or thereabout. The detectors will rely on several elements. We need fibers magically hanging in the volume for now. And there's a lot of engineering to do that magic. And I really mean it strongly because we've been for more than 10 years actually developing this magic. And a lot of this magic actually is being developed here abroad, as a matter of fact. And we would need basically new type of scintillators that are going to be opaque. They will be essentially milk-like or cloud-like or, yeah, marionette-like or anything. Essentially, this is basically what happens. Fibers, fast electronics, silicon PNs at the end of the fibers, and very fast electronics that is able to identify every single P. And this is an example of basically waveform reconstructions that we need in double show, for example, and is able to basically give you every single P in every single fiber. So that's the kind of things that we use essentially for Liquido. So let's build an event. So imagine that you have basically a detector with a lot of fibers, literally, right? And every single point here is given by Gen 4. It tells you I've got some energy deposition. In fact, these are basically two gammas from a positron annihilation. Every single point is a quantum. And the last point is the photoelectric effect, essentially associated with that. So every single point is just an electron, it's a point lag. And then what is going to happen is that every single point is going to transform into a little light bulb where there are tens of thousands of photons, essentially thousands of photons basically there. And then you have to multiply your detection efficiencies in the fiber, the collections. But what is going to happen is that in the top and the bottom, you're going to have two identical images. In principle, if you have some photo sensors, and these two images are carbon copies, essentially beam split 50-50, essentially to the top of the bottom by the fibers. And this means that everything that is correlated top to bottom means it's genuine light. Everything that's uncorrelated could be a fluctuation, but it could also be dark noise, for example, and things like that. So that also gives you basically a certain ability to basically cross-check and improve the quality of your images. What is very, very important now is that you see this detector is completely unsegmented. You just put the fibers in the space, and it's the opacity of the scintillator that is giving you an effective segmentation. We call that effect self-segmentation. In fact, you don't need to put any thing, you don't need to split your detector, the volume of your detector. This is just done automatically, essentially, by opacity. And this is actually very good in AMB because putting walls implies basically radioactivity in the detector. So that's very bad, general. At least you have to be very careful about that. If you're in the AMB, of course, if you're in the HAP and GEV, the only problem of that is that you're going to lose a lot of photons. You're going to hit essentially the walls, and the walls typically, even with a good reflector, you're going to lose a lot of the light there. So, long story short, what you get out of that is if you get more light, the light is always collected, providing that absorption is relatively negligible, essentially, in comparison, and you get this beautiful topology naturally, essentially, out of your detector. You may be wondering, well, in this simplest configuration, you can put fibers that way. Nothing other than your wallet basically prevents to do that. But you can also be tiny. And this basically is light. So basically, if you are in a nanosecond, picosecond basically regime, you can figure out the Z axis with some essentially caveats. Essentially, you need more light and so on. But you can basically figure out where more or less these positions are located. So this works like a typical TPC, but now TPC moving at the speed of light. In fact, you can think of Liquido. The best way to think of Liquido is a TPC, instead of using a slow electrons, photons. You just use, I mean, this is the highest duty cycle nature can allow. Providing neutrinos don't go faster than the speed of light. You may have heard about that in the past. So this is the images that basically we are basically talking about. So this is the positron annihilation. So you see basically the positron stop, DEDX. This is a positron at low energy. So we'll show you higher energies later on. And you see the annihilation back to back. In fact, this is basically the physics of a PET scanner, is to see the first PETs and actually the first quantum and try to work out in information. And you can see in Gen 4, this is the color is proportional to the amount of photons in every fiber. Every point is a fiber. You can see that you see better with opacity than with transparency. Transparency, in fact, washes out all that information. And in fact, maybe you can argue that this is not a point light. So this, you can say that this is not an electron with very high probability, but you wouldn't know that it's exactly basically a positron, as you would see there. You could say that maybe it's a gamma. And we'll talk about that. So this means that you can distinguish now electrons from positrons and gammas, and as soon as you do that, your shielding surrounding the detector is possibly gone. Because most of the reason we put the buffer, remember, is the gammas coming into the detector. So this means you're basically start removing shielding out of the detector. Hopefully we're going to work out on the cosmogenics, and that's the next step when it's gas. Now, once you have fibers, we can think of this simple scenario. This is the cheapest liquid or scenario. We call it one-dimension cheap liquid or vanilla liquid, if you want to put it that way. You get beautiful precision in X and Y, because you know the position of fibers. You can be sub-millimeter. The previous detector that I showed is 10 centimeters, so we have gone basically by almost three orders of magnitude in terms of position, two for three maybe. But now, basically, the timing basically is worked out on Z, as we highlighted, but now you can start playing some tricks, and this is just an example of that. How about if you start crossing your fibers? Now you can do the center of mass. If you move, if you think that the center, I mean, the event was here, what you will see is that your events diverge. Some fibers, they meet in one place, this is your position, and they diverge otherwise. So just by changing the position of the geometry of how you put the fibers, this is just a trivial example. If you can do the mechanics to do it, we're putting or whatever, you're very funky, I mean, you may have some tricks, Your mechanical engineer may suffer, but that's another issue. I mean, at this moment, but you will get much more information. What is beautiful of that is that you can combine position information with timing information and produce essentially the resolution Z, probably by another magnitude in comparison to just using timing. That typically you need more light. So let me give you another way to basically think of liquid. Imagine that you drop a little bit of ink in a glass. In fact, and you have a lot of information of what happened originally. If you wait basically to the infinity, this basically ink is going to diffuse and everything is lost. That's exactly a transparent detector. Everything's diffused. You cannot go back to what actually happened because information has been washed out. You have still the amount of ink, which is proportional to the energy, if you like this example, because that basically anchors our intuition. This is what we're doing today. Indeed. We don't have topology. And Liquido is going to basically try to do that. And it's done for free because the photons don't last forever. This is not like putting milk in your coffee and the milk stays forever and you get your coffee going from dark to basically brown or whatever. Okay? That's exactly the same rationale. In fact, the photons, ephemeral life, is going to last for a certain time, is going to essentially petrify a sort of anchoring time in essentially information. So, if you want better information, put more fibers, connect your photons faster. That's what it comes down to. So the game of Liquido is going away from is going from here to there. And that's essentially what Liquido is doing. With fibers in a funky way, ink is much easier, much slower. I agree with that. But we want to do that essentially just the speed of light, which is non-negligible, but it's still possible. Right. Long story short, once you have basically this formation of this light bulb, essentially you can find your information, this means that you can actually work out and get a lot of the topology. And now basically it's time to have fun to do physics on that. Now, before we actually get into the fun level, this has a little implication, which is that we need to now change the paradigm of scintillation. Because scintillation until now, it was about transparency. Anything that was not transparent, actually, we seem to be. Because it was useless basically for physics, or for detection, but I'll just end, long story short. So now we need to basically go back essentially to the origins, if you like, and start looking all the things that can scintillate and they don't have to be transparent natively. And it turns out that scintillation is actually a very mundane process in nature. Many things scintillate. What is very hard is to combine scintillation and transparency. That is very hard. Very, very hard. On the premier probability, as a matter of fact. So actually, we have a lot of things out there that could be scintillating, and they are opaque, and they have never been used. That's why you never heard about it, even not me, as a matter of fact. And this is exactly where you open a completely new universe of materials, science, and this is, of course, with a lot of people, essentially in the detection world, are going to just have an immense amount of fans. As a matter of fact, one of our best colleagues, our photochemist, material scientist, because a lot of that has been done already, and we just didn't use it because it was not transparent. Long story short. Let me give a couple of examples of that. What we're going to do, in fact, the way it works is very simple. Energy is deposited. Quantum mechanics is going to make basically get this energy transformed in your scintillator into non-radiated, because this quantum mechanics, I mean, is basically exciting the scintillator in your soul. So in fact, you have essentially, it's like a glass of water and you put a pinch of salt, and that pinch of salt is actually the Fermi level, is producing the light. And this is quantum mechanics is tunneling all this energy, as a matter of fact, and producing light of the little pinch of salt in the water. So this is actually typically the solvent, and this is the scintillator, the first scintillator. And what we normally do in transparent detectors is that we put photosensors directly, and we measure this light that is emitted. Or if you have a very, very large detector, alas, no glass that I showed before, you put a second scintillator, so the photons of this one get absorbed and re-emitted even closer to the greener, essentially, and you optimize these better with the photosensor, so your detector is even more transparent. That's basically how Juno works. That's how basically the offshore we work this way. We have BZSB, for example, this is just an example, and this is how Snowblast actually works, the detector I showed before. It's too big to just work on one single scintillator, so it will take two. In fact, what we do in Liquido is very, very simple. We just go rid of the second scintillator and we put the fibers. That's it. This works. Because we know that's exactly what it's tuned. So this is tuned to that, and basically the color is tuned, and that's it. That's what we're doing. And instead of photomultipliers, we put silicon photomultipliers, and we're done. So if you think about it, I mean, we are actually recycling almost 100 years of knowledge by basically doing, from that point of view of the detection chain. This is minor. This is a delta, basically, change in the detection chain. This means the efficiency is going to be high. We know the light levels relatively very well because we are basically in the shoulder of giants. This is 100 years, basically, of detection that we're basically relying on. Triplets, singlets, full shape, all that. Everything that works in the normal scintillators should work in the liquid, provided that the opacification is not basically going to spoil it. The first OPEC scintillator we built it in Paris, in fact, back in 2018, and we were doing something a bit funky. We were dreaming with an idea, and is that instead of basically we put something to opacify the scintillator, and we're wondering, okay, if we put now rubbish into the scintillator, that's going to kill the light. What if we put another scintillator in our liquid scintillator with the crystal scintillators? So we get the opacity, we get the scattering, and we also generate light. So we're not putting something that is going to kill the light, but it's something that is good to generate light. So in fact, we call this microcrystal scenario. If your crystals are nano, in fact, the light is not going to basically scatter enough, and you don't get it basically white enough, as a matter of fact. So this is why we have to stay in the micro, and this is because of the wavelength of the light that we're talking about. Long story short, so that was the first attempt, and worked to some extent. And then some colleagues of ours in Germany, Max Planck, in fact, they use wax. They waxify, so basically make the opacity. So this is like a candle. Remember a candle, when you heat it, essentially it gets transparent. You get liquid and transparent. And when it cools down, it becomes white. This is me scattering. The photons are scattering essentially the wax. Essentially, and this looks essentially like a candle. In fact, it's like a candle, but you can essentially put fire in it and it doesn't blow up. By the way, scintillators is the most stable way to have a lot of hydrogen just before it explodes. A bit more, and you have basically, in fact, your methane at home, as a matter of fact. This will cook, as a matter of fact. So see that scintillator that is just not stable enough. Another way to do that is emulsions. This is basically, you can call this milk. Milk is just water with some fat. Middle fat 3% typically, 1%. Some people can choose less, but it's actually a bit worse for the liquid point of view, better for health maybe. And so you have water, basically little droplets of water, micrometer. This is why milk is water. Milk is not black, sorry. This is why milk is white. Milk is not white because it's white. Milk is white because the photon is scattered through me scattering. You see, this is exactly as a cloud. And a mayonnaise is the opposite. It's oil with a little bit droplets of milk of water, and this is why mayonnaise and milk look exactly the same color, even though you could consider this a negative of one or the other in terms of composition, in terms of water. So emulsions, we can do it. So if we take a liquid scintillator, we put a little water, we have basically a white system, instantaneous, essentially. In that case, there will be more mayonnaise. If you take water and you put a bit of scintillator, this is more what people call water-based liquid scintillators, but still you get it white. Very easy. You can try. Just give it a shake and you will have it right away. So we have several ways to do these opacification. So we can use wax, we can do emulsions, we can do microcrystal. We have tried nanocrystals, they are not that good. And the reality is that we have several ideas which are secret right now, but we have at least two or three or more ideas that we haven't basically put into publications. And all of these ideas basically, roughly speaking, they work all of that. Now we are not just in the press. If you want to make detectors, you need to master the size of the light bulb to the proportional to the fibers, to sampling problem, and this is the level that we're at. Essentially, there is an immense amount of basic physics that you can get there. We are actually even sponsored, essentially, by, oh, we got an extra 1 million euros as part of one of our projects in the European Community and the UKRI, in fact, to actually explore that. So actually, we're encouraged to really push the opaque scintillation, basically, paradigm in many ways, and improve fibers and so on and so forth. And here, we're basically now creating technology for the long story short. As for today, we're using the technology. Now, there is another interesting feature, essentially, of liquido, is when you actually go into the, basically, the noodle level. So this is basically what you may call, basically, the typical detectors with a lot of scintillation fibers, and you didn't have hardly any scintillator. So this is just fiber and hardly any scintillator. This actually has been done before. Even if the scintillator is very transparent, you have done this kind, we have done this kind of things before, but this costs an immense amount of readout. Every noodle is a fiber, and you have to read it out. In fact, liquid works more in the noodle soup scenario. So in fact, you have more soup, more scintillator, liquid scenario. And this means that with less channels, you get the same level of information. And that's the power. The opacity that happens essentially in the broth is exactly what we want in liquid. So you get almost the same level of information, but you use much less channels. Long story short, you can call it optimization. At the end of the day. So liquid is just optimize it with opacity these costs. Long story, which by the way has been done and it's very expensive. Right, so that's roughly speaking on that level. But now, if you have that scintillator that can be opacified, this means that you can add a lot of things that before it was forbidden. Anything that screwed up, essentially your transparency, it was forbidden. And as a matter of fact, everything screws up your transparency. Anything you do is just against transparency. So if you want very good transparent vector, long story short, you cannot basically put it anything on that. And it turns out that now if your detector, you want it to be transparent, this means that you're going to start basically loading your detector. You can now basically not a pinch of salt, but you take a big, basically, big spoon and you throw stuff into your detector because that is going to give it opacity, maybe for free, and hopefully it's going to do all the physics. Now, this is interesting if you are basically in the low energy because the scintillator is one of the most rare things that you can actually handle in your life. In fact, Borek Signal has made this number 10 to the minus 19, essentially gram per gram during thorium. This means that in the MEV, you almost eliminated, you hoover up essentially all the basically uranium thorium. Well, that's a bit more complicated, but nonetheless, this is good. Fibers are very clean. Anything that is plastic is actually very, very good. Segmentation, we said you don't need it. You need folders. You need to put anything to the detector because that means betas and alphas and anywhere, all kind of relativity rubbish. So you don't want that. Photosensors are going to be far away. You don't have to put the photomultipliers reading the whole thing. So no photomultipliers, no buffer, no reactivity from the basically from the metal. Remember, photomultipliers use metals, silicon PMC, semiconductors. These are rather really pure as opposed to the metal of the multiplier. And this means that now we can dope your system with anything. So let me just give you an example of how we have done physics in neutrino on that. So if you take a liquid scintillator, this is almost an absolute, basically, purified system by nature. Carbon 14 essentially is 99% essentially of any carbon constituent. Hydrogen is also very clean. And what people have done, remember the discovery of the neutrino, it was done by Reynolds, using a little bit of cadmium, pinch of cadmium in your liquid scintillator, actually in the water, in fact, I mean, to get basically your capture of neutrino, on the scintillator, in fact, on the scintillator. You may have heard about loading gadolinium, loading on lithium. This is what we've done so far because it worked on the pinch level. But what if you start adding a new element, for example, lead, that has a cross-section, for example, of neutrino, and this is 500 times larger, the cross-section with lead, that it would be natively with neutrinos in a carbon system. That is the kind of thing. That this means you can do completely new physics. You can do neutral current or charge current. This means that now you can put so much stuff in your detector that your detector becomes, I mean, your doping is actually becomes an actual target. And this up to now has been impossible so far. The other possibility that you can do, and you may have heard about that, there is a Kamdan-Zen experiment, is actually put a huge amount of double beta, for example, elements, and use your scintillator detector as a diffuse double beta basically system. And that is actually has been done, and you can get maybe to the top level. So this means this physics has been very, very practical so far. Kamdan-Zen has been working for a while, actually, the world record in double beta in terms of, and this has been done since a long time. But trying to do this kind of thing, this has been so far impossible because putting this amount of loading was basically making your scintillator pain. Let me give you the latest status of the R&D a little bit faster, sorry. Liquid is a collaboration. We are about 100 basically people. Five in Barcelona just joined not long ago. So our first paper actually came just after a seminar at CERN in 2019. We were in the middle of COVID. I mean, what a bad time, I mean, to release the project. I mean, but c'est la vie, we didn't choose everything. And very recently, probably the highlight essentially is that in March last year, in July last year, we released two papers that we call Liquid-01 and Liquid-02. This is a sort of monolithic small detector, makes sort of things like the snow that I showed before. And this is more of a mute tracker. I'm going to give you a highlight of the results. You can find things in our card. This paper is out in Jeans, and this paper is being reviewed as we speak. So this is a little detector, monolithic detector. This is how a liquid detector may look like. This is a little bit over design, a lot of fibers, we're talking about 7 millimeters between each fiber, a lot of that. If you think about how much the cost of that is a small prototype costs an immense amount of money on the readout level. But this later on, the detector would scale very nicely. In fact, the detector, liquid detector, like spaghetti growing. So if the fibers are long, you can grow very high, and you still read the out at the end of the fiber. So spaghetti, any spaghetti direction, directionality is good for a liquid detector. This detector, we fill it with water, so with Cherenkov. We fill it with scintillator, normal scintillator, and then a scintillator that can become opacified by using temperature, this was wax. So we warm up the detector, it becomes transparent, we cool it down 5 degrees, and it becomes basically opaque. So this is basically the transparent configuration. You can see 1/r². This is what you expect. Every point basically is the fiber. And this is what the detector basically is called. Essentially, we make the light bulb. And most of the light, almost basically 50, 60% of the light is in 2 fibers. In fact, the light bulb is extremely confined. This is what we measure in data. This is what the Monte Carlo says that you should see. In fact, you see every single point here is where the photons interact. And you can see the photons only interact when they hit the fiber directly. Whereas when you actually ask the Monte Carlo, I mean, how this looks like, the photons are interacting everywhere. That's scattering. In fact, you don't even see the fiber to a large extent because the photons are interacting brutally well before you get to the fibers. And this is roughly speaking the confinement that we talked about. So we inject monoenergetic electrons in this system. It's actually very hot, but actually possible. And you will see why we do that. We have a very fast electronic that was able basically to measure every single P, even distinguish 2 P's within a very small fraction of the nanosecond. And this is our data basically with water. So what you see here is this is the beam was injected here. This is 1/r², roughly speaking. Cherenkov light is a bit forward. But this is low energy EV. This is not a punch to particle. This is a very scattering particle. An electron at 1 eV, essentially the Mourier rate is huge, as a matter of fact. So it scatters a lot. And this is beautifully, basically, the Cherenkov light. And this is, you can think, is the fibers. This is the decay of the fibers. These are fast fibers, but still, there is no time of light correction. No correction whatsoever. What you see is the wrong data as it comes out of the data. So this is as clear as you can possibly do. But then you can basically fill it. This is filled with water. But you can fill it with scintillator and inject electrons monoenergetically from low energy to high energy. The energy threshold, the Cherenkov threshold, is about 300, 400 keV. You can see that the Cherenkov is appearing, smoking gun. So we're seeing it beautifully, the Cherenkov versus scintillation, just out of the box. No calibration on time whatsoever. Without showing it away, because that is, if you have a detector that just out of the box give you that, imagine when you start touching and calibrating the whole detector. So this is, to me, this is the power to see a crude detector that gives you that. And this is something that even in transparent detectors, very, very frequently, the best experiments in the planet are reaching something like that. So this is just out of the box, and that's where you see the power. And I remind you basically again, these electrons are as highly scattering. So this Cherenkov is not light moving forward. It's light that is scattered because the photon is scattering, essentially. And we can distinguish Cherenkov light scintillation light. And this is very interesting for calorimetry. I mean, you have this dual calorimetry concept, essentially. It's called dual calorimetry, right? For calorimeters, essentially, in colliders. And it's about separating this information, but we have it in there. Right, if you actually now optimize your scintillator, you can see this is, you get much more light, 100 times almost more, and you may be wondering, oh, if you actually have a scattering, you may have spoiled your timing a little bit. And you're right, absolutely. You can see this is transparent, and this is with the scattering. You can see that there is a little bit of a tail, if you speak in a nanosecond, but this means your timing is well preserved, your rise time is well protected, and your blade time, I mean, that you don't use all, essentially for your timing, is a little bit slower than expected. More scattering, this is going to get, of course, worse, evidently so. But you can tune this if you want to do a time of flight or a fast system, you may tune things, I mean, essentially to get your preserving time. Okay, so this is basically something to keep in mind. And this is basically the light bulb. This is a little, basically, light bulb. So what you're going to see is data with different energies. And you can see that regardless of the energy, you have the same light bulb because it's a fractional effect. Excuse me. And this is an analytical basic example, not even Monte Carlo, to make it mathematically very simple. Even a mathematical simple model of the scattering actually works beautifully out of the box. So this is basically within 2 centimeters, half of the light is essentially 2 centimeters, half of the light is detected. Within essentially, if you want 90%, you need 5 centimeters. So 5 centimeters, and you're detecting 90% of your photons. And the light level increases. Okay. So indeed, I mean, this is what we call liquid O, is because the detector after 10 centimeters is opaque. You don't see anything beyond. In fact, it's as dark as it is. It's as useful for detection as your shoes. Well, some funky shoes, maybe. Anyway, putting that aside, I mean, this is now another little tracker. This was done in Sussex University, our colleagues, and with the contributions of all the people. This is basically how liquid OPEX indicator similar. This is now when it has been solidified. This is basically what it's called. This is how the detector looks like when the detector has been warm up. And you can see this indicator looks just beautifully transparent. Exactly the same mechanism that I just showed before. This picture is beautiful, in fact. And we can now do tracking. So this is basically, they have some little nice tags where you can see the neon basically comes within. This is a little neon telescope if you want. I just put a little diagram to say you can, your neon is somewhere in there. And these are basically the liquid or data that basically the neon is actually going there. And you can see it. But this is a Monte Carlo basic example that you can even try to see delta rays and so on and so forth. Again, you have this aurora around there that you're tracking on the millimeter, sub-millimeter level. And this is actually, did I do something? Well, this is maybe, this is the liquid O2 paper. I'm not sure what came out. And this is basically the tracking capability, essentially in transparent mode, and this is in opaque mode. You can see we're sub-millimeter already. And this basically is on the level of half, essentially 500 micrometers. But we think with the simulation, we have been extrapolating, optimizing for a non-optimized detector for that configuration. If we optimize the detector, we need that with simulation. We think that we can go below 100 micrometers. And 100 micrometers, this is already very scary numbers when it comes to tracking precision. Okay. These are very tiny detectors. Of course, if you have a bigger detector, you get even better time. So long story short, if you actually combine the outcome of these two papers, we have essentially convinced ourselves the confinement work just as expected. We see the topology of the electrons, which is basically every point in the quantum electron. We understand our energy level. This detector, we lowered the energy level on purpose to be able to scale and to understand the scaling very well. And if you have any questions, don't hesitate to ask. With this scaling, we know that we can go basically to the level of hundreds of p per mm, and certainty is a bit larger. This is always typical of a prototype. And with the liquid O2 paper, we were able to demonstrate the sub-millimeter tracking capability. We see the topology of the muon, essentially we see the tracks, we see the points, long story short, and we can measure a light level that is consistent to the predictions there. So everything is just a beautiful, happy story. Long story short, with those two papers, we consider, I mean, we are closing to some extent, essentially, the R&D of demonstration R&D, and now we're moving into the R&D of pushing, optimizing, and getting basically things even better. Long story short, getting more light, getting more tracking, getting more everything. So that's basically what we're moving, and this is basically the next phase of the collaboration. So a summary, when it comes to basically Liquido, is probably we are able to, we demonstrated the stochastic light confinement, we demonstrated that we can confine the light, we are demonstrating that we can measure shedding of light, scintillation, we can use any medium, liquid and solid. Gas is a bit harder to make opacity enough. I don't know how to do it, but if anybody has a good idea, don't hesitate to propose. We're able to dope. We actually did dope. And we actually basically opened this new paradigm of opaque scintillation. So long story short, it looks like a happy story so far. And despite coming halfway through. So we believe that liquid basically just works. In fact, I would say even significantly better than even we thought in the region, and even with a careful Monte Carlo. But let me get beyond that. And so let me show you some images of the capabilities. So we're moving from this paradigm where we use photon multipliers, we have this buffer, and we actually, the right way, well, the possible way is to eliminate the photon multipliers, put some fibers, but if you just do that, that doesn't work. What you need to do is to get opacity, so you need fibers and opacity to really work out what happens inside the detector. So just the fibers, actually some people did that before, it doesn't work out. It's very expensive and you don't get more light, actually you get less light and it doesn't work out. So let's try to now get to a point light, basically information, track information, which is a configuration of that, or any non-appearing information, any possible basically topology of the detector, and let's see how that works. So far, it has been impossible, basically, to distinguish electrons, positrons, and gammas. These gammas are the nasty reason why detectors use buffers. So this is the nasty reason why one third of the detector size is gone. If you're able to distinguish that from a possible neutrino or an antineutrino, instantaneously your detectors don't have any buffer. This means that all this huge volume that costed you millions of euros, essentially, to dig out, you can use it. A third of that, so this means your detector multiplies by a factor of four. All this information was washed out by the transit time spread of photon multipliers. Transit time spread of photon multipliers, in a very good photon multipliers, 1 nanosecond, 1 nanosecond of speed of light in this medium is 20 centimeters. Anything within 20 centimeters is just washed out. This is just, when you have a better telescope, sometimes you figure out that there are two stars instead of only one. It's a very simple resolution problem. That's what we had. And this is the kind of imaging that we're talking about. A positron is almost half a meter basically beast. An electron is actually millimeter beast. Ironically, in our detectors, I'm sure Juno, whatever, we are not able to tell the difference between half a meter and 5 millimeter. This is the reality of what's happening today in our detectors. For this reason, we have to put it on the ground. If we're able to tell the difference between millimeters and half a meter, that's remarkable. We can do a lot more physics. And this is a gamma. This will be typical in physics. And sometimes you have neutral current used for gammas. But let's put that aside. This is typical relativity. This means you can actually remove your shielding and do things like that. For example, in a reactor neutrino, antineutrinos, all your cosmogenics are beta minus. This means that if you're able to distinguish an electron from a positron, your cosmogenics are gone. This means, in principle, you can do reactor neutrinos on surface. Nobody has ever tried. Well, no, people have tried. People, it was very hard. You can look at the first neutrino experiment of Reines for the neutrino discovery. They were on surface and they didn't match, as a matter of fact. It was the second one where they realized that actually it's cool, it's become the ground. And that was the one that basically matched a few years later. So, in fact, the idea is to really get detectors on surface and demonstrate that whether that is actually true. Can we get neutrino detectors now on surface? And that would be a major change in the paradigm. So, this would imply that we can change entirely our shielding strategy, if these gammas can be gone, and we can then change our overbarring strategy. I remind you that basically putting a detector on the ground just by making the hole is super expensive. I mean, I think it was in June, it was probably €500 million, if I remember correctly, more or less, the new laboratory on the ground. And the detector actually was much more expensive. So this means that half of the money went into making a hole as opposed to making a better detector. It's a beautiful detector, I like it very much. But if you put twice the money on that, I mean, maybe you get even a better. Now, if you want to distinguish electrons from positrons, from gammas, the idea is to all this washed out information. And let me just give you into context our latest data. So this was our paper in the past with Monte Carlo. This is what we get out of the detector. This is of the 5 centimeters. We did it on purpose at Monte Carlo. We wanted to be protective, if you like, to be conservative. We make it be line bolts. And this is what we're measuring in the laboratory. So if you scale that, this is just a simple example. You would be getting off that level. This is not totally correct. The light bulb is proportional to the energy, actually to the log of the energy, like a calorimeter, and you would be able to distinguish that very straightforward. Roughly speaking, we expect a factor of 100 of rejection electron to gamma with 90% efficiency, roughly. And that is just, consider that this is just impossible today, but that's already quite a big step forward. So if we're able to come back essentially to our snow blast detector, these gammas would be eliminated because they are recognized. So you don't care about that anymore. You can make the detector bigger. If you make the detector bigger, you go from using only 10% of the full space that you have, maybe to 80, 90%. This is a dream, of course. But this is basically the kind of potential you can get on that. So this means that every single meter cube of excavation you pay for goes into an internal detector. That doesn't mean that you make it bigger. That means actually you discover less, generally, as a matter of fact. And we can have native tracking, as you saw, the neons to the millimeter level. This means that anything that happens along the neon track, we can figure it out. So now we can tag the neon within even less than a millimeter and see what happens all around that. This means that we're changing entirely the paradigm of basically neutrino detection, because the neon, if you ask me, one single feature that we need out here and revolutionize the entire field, the neons. The neon is cosmogenic. The cosmogenic is go on the ground. If you change, we change that, you change the entire field. That's really at the level that we are potentially there. It depends, of course, on your physics. The neon may hit you different if you're on an antineutrino, if you're on a neutrino, but the potential is almost getting there. Now, let's imagine that we have a beautiful GEV accelerator somewhere, shooting basically nice particles, for CP violation. And this is what an antineutrino, now a 2 GeV, would look like. You get your electromagnetic shower. But now you can see almost the Monte Carlo truth right in front of your eyes. And you can see your gammas. These are simple gammas. There are some annihilations, some gammas of annihilation. You can see basically you have your pi minus that decays into a mu minus and decays into a Michel electron. And it's a Michel electron, because you remember, if this was a Michel positron, you should see the annihilation of the positron. And you don't see it, this means you can track, even with a magnetic field. That's beautiful. And remember that almost all the particles finish in a pile in a tail, and this implies, long story short, that you can track without magnetic field. You don't have to care, but if you have it, even better. But magnetic field depends on how the particle is oriented. Your magnetic field here, you don't care about the orientation. You get PID regardless in which direction magnetic field goes, which is actually cute. And then you can see neutrons, which is very important because a lot of the energy of the neutrino goes into the neutrons, and you can see a neutron very slowly, you will see it in 1 second. Proton recoils brutally, and this is a lot of the energy of the neutrino went into this guy. So if you want to reconstruct your neutrino energy, your really true energy to make oscillation physics or any physics, the energy of this guy, in fact, if you miss these guys, you're in serious trouble. Serious trouble. Because a lot of the energy goes there. I'll give you one example in 1 second. So this means that we can actually basically get a lot of this information. With time of flight, in addition, you can measure the energy of the neutrons. And I thought you'll see it in 1 second. And everything that you see there has been effectively validated by the liquid of one paper and liquid of two paper. The tracks are there, the points are there, everything is there. Every point that you see in there is just an electron, as a matter of fact. Unsurprising, there is a lot of electrons in an atom. Turns out to be. Right. All the topology, basically building blocks, have been validated. So everything, the GEV, in many ways, is just a step. It's easier. You have more energy, you have more stuff, you have more topology, you can do it in many ways. So if I take the words in the NED, in general, this should be relatively an easy way. So this is just to give an example of a Michel positron. Looks like basically an electron, a track with fireworks. And this is a Michel electron and Michel positron. So I just go back very quickly. Sorry about that. If you have a positron here, the Michel positron, you would have seen these annihilation gammas. You would have seen some of these little things out there. And you would have said, oh, this is a biplas. As a matter of fact, new plas, Michel positron. And you track the sign. And this image is just for, this is just to highlight that you can tell the difference between those two. And you don't care about magnetic field orientation. And bear in mind that as you go in different angles, you may not be aligned to the magnetic field depending on the position. And then here you have tracking, so you can get directionality and so on and so forth. So, for example, this event, you can consider that is a supernova neutrino and a supernova anti-neutrino. This is the right energy, as a matter of fact. So you're actually testing supernova or decay arrest accelerators, as a matter of fact. That's exactly the kind of event. This means you can distinguish the sign. This means you can do even CP violation with them. That's funky. Now, this is an event. I'm going to put it back. You see neutrons. Boom, boom, boom. You can see the neutron, and you can see how it stops there. All the energy, a lot of the energy went into those neutrons because you're punching essentially the nuclei and all of the energy going into that. Some of the nuclei are direct, some of them are generated, and it's, you know, it's very complicated interaction basically system as you go into GEV, but you can see a lot of information. I chose on purpose these more, I mean, less precision. This is a detector that you make the light bulbs somewhat thicker. So we use scattering, it's less scattering, but you can see you can play with that. You want a better detector, you make it thinner, and you put more fibers. In this case, it's overdesigned. You can clearly see that you have so many fibers and you need to go with. And this is completely overdesigned. This is just an example. This is not an optimized detector at all. I'm just going to put it again so you can see. So this is the speed of light. In fact, there is a clock here. I just try to stop it because you will see that within a few nanoseconds, it's actually. Can I stop it? Ah, I did that. No, I didn't do that. But if you go very quickly, I put it there. Within a few nanoseconds, see. 2 nanoseconds, you see the development of the event. So you're seeing how, you're seeing that the event is coming from here and it's going that way. The reconstruction is a prominent in the part. If you have a TPC, for example, with electrons, you get a frozen image. In this event, it's easy to know your neutrino came that way, by the way, the accelerator is that way, which is relatively easy. But in some other physics like atmospherics, that is not that easy. And that varies your background sometimes. Okay? So anyway, this is just giving you handles and handles in the static image again. And this is basically proton decay. In supercamicambe, for example, or in hypercamicambe. And this is an interesting channel. This channel, the positron, is your electron disappearance. This is your CP violation channel, and this is your background CP violation, pi zero production. And you can see that a pi zero can be separated from a positron or an electron. It doesn't matter because the shower is a shower. Okay? So this is basically your neutral current background in CP violation. This is your main background, because this in hypercamicambe and supercamicambe can look like this. And you can see it will. Okay, it's maybe a nice event. Maybe it's a master event, but yeah, life is. But this is the kind of thing that you can do. And this means that you can try, you can say, oh, this is not going to be necessarily bigger than hyper-K. But remember that the efficiency of hyper-K on this channel is about 10%. 10%. This means that your detector is 10 times smaller effectively. So you can do basically that. Now, who says that proton decay decays this channel? In fact, nobody knows. Proton decay wouldn't know how it's going to decay. So it's good to check in all possible channels, and this is the kind of thing that we're trying to look in liquid. But we do proton decay in all different ways, because that's one single channel, because that's a channel of supercamic candles. If you look at Juno and Dune, they use the KMDK, and they use timing for that. That's beautiful. Actually, Dune doesn't use timing because I didn't have the timing. Juno uses the timing, but the Dune decay is beautiful. KMDK, that's beautiful. But that's only one channel. And what are all the channels? I remind you, proton decay means new physics. Yes or yes. In fact, that's the ANDE, or chemical ANDE, supercamic ANDE, hypercamic ANDE, is the ANDE, is neutron, nucleon decay. That is Nobel Prize physics, 100%. Right, I stop there. I mean, just a little summary. So liquido is about basically using opacity, the thing that we try to avoid, the thing that we have been trying to basically kill since ever, turns out to be our ally. We just have to change the detector a little bit, fair enough. Technology was not up to this level in the past, so I mean, that's a lot, but we're getting there. And this means that we can have imaging, topology, PID. I mean, it depends on your physics. I cannot speak from plus minus infinity, and for all, by all possible means, liquid, there are some things that it cannot do. We can discuss about that in the questions. And but there are probably a lot of things that it can do. We have these five primitive information, energy, position, and time. It works like an effective TPC at the speed of light. Highest duty cycle, it means you can put it on some surface. That's no problem whatsoever. Principle, in fact, we're doing that with a nuclear reactor. So imagine, I mean, with a beam, if that was the case. Uniform calorimetry with a lot of information. Stochastic and non-stochastic, relatively whatever understood. The reality is that it works like a time of flight in multi-dimension. That's what you saw, the muon. I mean, you can do the time of flight of a neutron. Sorry, I said muon, a neutron. You saw the neutron. This is just a time of flight measurement. That's essentially what it comes down. So we have a calorimeter with a time of flight system, with an imaging system, working as a TPC. That's what we could spell. In fact, you cannot really speak of either. It's all at the same time. All at the same time. I cannot define it a better way. This is why I make this a slide, I mean, because maybe it summarizes. And in addition, hopefully, we can dope it, put a stuff that makes even more physics for the detector. Remember, if you have a scintillator, it's hydrogen and carbon, natively. You may say, well, that's not my physics, it's for hydrogen and carbon. Well, dope. That's as much as we can do at this moment. Water also is oxygen and hydrogen, and that's what it is. Can we make it big? Well, it turns out NOVA in the US is our R&D. They don't know it, actually, but this is our liquid R&D in terms of the scaling. In fact, the scintillator, these fibers, segmentation, we don't care. And the light collection, they actually get a reasonable light collection, but we can improve that, obviously speaking, by a factor of 10. We believe that we understand that, especially as soon as we remove the segmentation. Photosensor, they use different from silicon PMs. That was another other invoke. We believe that we can do that, essentially. So to a large extent, this is a detector that can go about 60 meters, and we remember that NOVA had a fiber that is twisted and goes up, and if read out on one side, we can do that. We can do that. So long story short, NOVA is already demonstrating that we can make this detector reasonably big. It depends on the physics. Doesn't have to be always there, but clearly, I mean, NOVA is a beautiful example that we can make this technology scale. So I think I'm going to just repeat myself, so maybe no need for that. To a large extent, I think we're very satisfied at this moment. I mean, we are very happy to see that. These two papers, very important papers, they really put the demonstrated experimentally what we think that it was needed to say liquid works as planned. And the next level is just improve or part improve. And if people are interested in, I mean, please think about that. And maybe your physics works, maybe it doesn't. That's it. Thanks so much.
Thank you. No problem. Okay. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Very nice talk. So let's move questions.
I've got this question for you. I was wondering if you could say, I mean, you said at the beginning you'd speak all about Juno physics. I wonder if you can talk a bit about, you know, other uses of liquido technology. I mean, you know, you mentioned dual readout calorimetry,
for example.
So, I mean, you know, how, you know, if we're talking about future collider calorimeters, you know, what are the, how easily does it scale? What are the where does it fall down? If it does fall down, what's missing at the moment for that kind of?
First disclaimer, I'm not a provider of this system, and since I've been long time ago. I did a little bit at some point, but anecdotally. So please, what I'm going to say, maybe please correct me, don't hesitate. So in fact, there is already a liquido calorimetry project in France, in fact, that derived, people are looking into that by using microcrystals with essentially a tungsten, very high density, as a matter of fact. And they realized that actually this is the LHCb people. They are actually, they have this segmented calorimeter, and they realized that actually very bad to have the segmented calorimeter, the sandwich calorimeter like. And the resolution that you get with calorimeter of this type, I didn't highlight this for the not to derive too much, but in the resolution is just standard. In fact, using stochastic something to stochastic something, which is the stochastic term of the calorimetry, and it's extremely good. So there is some testing data, as a matter of fact, and it's looking very good. Now, in addition, I mentioned the tungsten because I just wanted to have increase the density to make the calorimeter more compact. But imagine you want to emphasize an electromagnetic calorimeter, so you use basically more carbon and halogen, that would be great. Imagine that you want to emphasize and compensate the calorimeter or something like that. You want to emphasize your neutrons. A lot of neutrons, or capture the neutrons. So in a way, by actually being able to dope, you are not constrained essentially to a very specific material, but you can actually make a salad of material, as a matter of fact. You can actually basically play with that, with a put of uranium, if you like, you know, probably this calorimeter. So you can play with a lot of tricks on there. And you just put a pinch, depending on what you need. And then you can imagine, for example, a detector that you have certain composition at the very beginning. So you don't want to spoil your beautiful electromagnetic calorimeter for some beautiful electromagnetic channels, X like or thereabout. And then you have your hadronic basically part where you want to really compact even more and emphasize essentially neutrons or whatever. You can do that. So you can actually have a detector, even a relatively uniform calorimeter, using only one single cone technology. Advantage, you can change the circulator anytime. It's a liquid. You can remove it. If there is any, for example, deterioration with exposure, well, you can just change the circulator, peanuts. I mean, our detectors are much bigger than your calorimeters in general, so just change the calorimeter. Back problem, fibers. Your radiation is going to probably affect the fibers. I'm not an expert on that, but you know much better than I do. Probably the fibers is going to be an issue when it's exposed to very high radiation. It's a plastic. I'm not sure how it works on that. There are alternatives to do that. You can use quartz fibers or things like that. There are other ways to basically try out things. It would be more expensive on the one hand, but maybe last for longer. This is beyond my range now. But there are possible ways to basically play that game. Not so sure I hope satisfied on that, but I'm not really an expert on that.
Yeah, thank you very much.
No problem. But you saw, if you don't mind me just emphasizing, imagine these kind of events. In fact, I mean, and this is your electromagnetic shower, of course, there is to compact. And this was, sorry, I didn't emphasize this. This is about 3 meters in liquid scintillator because this is very low density. And the idea is that you make this much more condensed, but you have particle flow and particle flow is called. Particle flow, which is, we call it energy flow.
We'd love to have a picture like this.
Exactly. Imagine you have many of those, and we can actually use the segmentation that you can get out of that. Of course, if you compact just from solid angle, you are piling everything up in the same position, but that's the thing that you can play depending on your energy and so on and so forth. That this is you're looking. Maybe the forward, you can try a different way. Some rapidity you can apply in one way or another. This is beyond my physics, but I hope it inspires.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Pleasure.
I was going to come to one of the comments you made right at the beginning. You talked about relic neutrino, which haven't yet been observed. So how are you defining relic neutrinos? What about the very high energy neutrinos?
These are the ones that you couple during essentially the nuclear thin cities. And these are basically cooled down essentially as the universe expanded, and they are so low energy that nobody knows how to detect that. I mean, there is a Polymer, I think, is the project, one of the projects using very cold cryogenics and trying to basically measure some of that. But very honestly, very elegant experiment, by the way. Very tough physics. I'm not sure if liquid will ever get that. I was not suggesting that this was in the beginning of liquid, by the way. I think on that, maybe that's the moment where liquid, I'm not sure how you would get there.
No, that's.
But it's a beautiful channel. That would tell you you're really seeing essentially a relic of the Big Bang in the same way that we're seeing the Maxwell.
So what? EV?
Oh, yes, I think so.
Max 4 EV.
It's a
I give up that one.
So they would not interact directly, though, so they would be, it's very sophisticated. Very sophisticated. But worth fighting. If anybody knows how to do that, I mean, for sure people will remember it.
So then, other question. You talked about gaseous stuff. Is it possible to have any sort of particulate type of gas? So you've got, like smoke.
Yeah.
So you've got particles, and presumably they settle over time, but you could blow.
You have scintillating gases like CF6, that it was used in the past, in fact, and so on. Not very good for the ozone, but that's anecdotic. Big issue, I think, there, this is my take, I've never tried. I think, in principle, it's not impossible. The problem is going to be basically to get enough scattering to get to punch in a way. Like a cloud chamber. I don't think that we would have that capability in a way. Because you need to, for example, a cloud chamber, as you know, you see the alpha is super low. They are very long tracks. They would be in liquid, density about one. An alpha is about, if you're lucky, between 10 to 100 micrometers. So it's maybe the thickness of my neck, long story short. So, by using the gas, you will see these very low tracks at low energies. But the problem is how to opacify, how to get enough opacity, how to confine enough with something that has very low density. A cloud, in a way, it would be something where it's a cloud-like system, but a cloud actually is very low density anyway. So I'm not sure how to do that. In a way, the two things kind of feed one another. I suspect, for example, very often the question comes out, can we do dark matter in the KV, 110th of KV or something like that? I don't think liquid would work there very well. Because as you go lower and lower in energy, if you have a liquid, everything is more uneven light bulb. And so a positron is a point, an electron is a point, a proton is a point, everything is a point. So, you have point, before you come back to the original problem. You don't have PID. So, for example, that is the kind of range where liquid would work. You can, with liquid scintillator, lower the density, probably 0.6. You may correct me, 0.6, 0.5, that's already funky. Maybe you can try something like that, and then your events are a factor of two longer by lowering the density. But again, you would have to play with maybe other material. Gas, I just don't know. That's what I really need it. If anybody had a good idea, please call me anytime.
I think there's a team forming.
Oh, yes.
Sorry.
Okay.
Not my fault. They keep asking questions.
No. I think we can talk. You are still around the department, so we can talk on Donatel in the corridor.
My pleasure. I'm down to Friday.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. So we have to close the seminar now. Thanks also for people on Zoom. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.